Welcome back to BCFM's Politics Show, Friday Drive Time, with Old Labour Oxford economist Martin Summers and me, Tony Gosling. We go to the heart of the police's failure to act today in the phone hacking case and other failings at the Met. So, the murder of private investigator Daniel Morgan and subsequent failures at the Metropolitan Police open a can of worms that Leveson has barely touched on. Plus, the National Health Service workers are on the march tomorrow, but why are they so opposed to regional pay? Gwyneth Powell is here with some answers. Plus, Bristol has a big ethnic Somali population, but why is that? And what's been going on in Somalia that makes life so difficult over there? Latif Ismail will be here to explain. Plus, Martin Summers' weekly tour of the world's hotspots. But we start this week with Alistair Morgan, who's the brother of private investigator Daniel Morgan. So, hi Alistair, and welcome to Drive Time.
Hi, thanks for having me on.
First of all, Alistair, could you just give us a little brief introduction to who your brother was and tell us a bit about him?
Yeah, my brother was a private investigator. He was age 37 when he died, and he was married with two small children. And he was found axed to death in the car park of a pub in South London in March 1987, and what's transpired since then is such that my family are still open-mouthed, even at this stage, as to the way the case has been handled by the police, the vista which has sort of opened up to us since the collapse of a prosecution last year, and I never ever dreamed that I would ever be in the situation that I'm in today as a result of a murder 25 years ago.
So, I mean, I suppose the obvious first question is, what sort of things was your brother investigating when he was murdered?
He had a sort of all-round private investigation company. He worked for people like insurance companies, banks, local authorities, private companies, etc., etc., generally in the field of fraud. For example, shortly before he died, he was tracing a ring of people that was stealing expensive cars or hiring expensive cars under false identity and shipping them out of the country, stealing them, basically. That's all sorts of work, but that sort of thing. And he, I believe, or in fact I'm quite sure, came upon some serious police corruption which he wanted to expose, and we believe 25 years later, after having followed closely, or as closely as we can, the five investigations into his murder, that he was a whistleblower. And not only that, but allegations were made at an inquest into his murder in 1988 that a serving police officer was involved in setting up a contract murder on my brother, and was involved in a plan to take over his company after the murder. And it's a very, very, very unusual story, and very troubling for my family, and still is. In fact, after 25 years, we're probably more troubled about it, if possible, than we were 10 years ago.
Now, it sounds to me as if, you're in a situation there where you have expected the sort of justice system to kick in, you yourself have come up with evidence, and then the police are then investigating the police. I mean, this is a serious difficulty, isn't it? We've had lots of problems with the Independent Police Complaints Authority. There was a panorama about them the week before last, for example. I mean, how did you initially find that the police did when it came to investigating Daniel's murder?
The first inquiry, after the collapse of the prosecution last year, the Met finally admitted that the first inquiry had was corrupted, which we had known since 3 weeks after Daniel's murder. We were aware of this, and we had alerted the Home Office. There was an outside inquiry into it, which of course found nothing.
Well, look, let me interrupt you there, because what was the first indication that you had that something wasn't quite right about the way the police were investigating your brother's murder?
Well, I mean, I visited the incident room on the evening after the murder, and on the evening, I visited the incident room three times in the immediate aftermath of the murder on the days after, and I was bemused by the reception that I got from the police. It just seemed to me that after the second meeting, I thought, I know there's something wrong here. I do not know what it is, but something feels very wrong here. And then 3 weeks into the murder, the police arrested three serving police officers, along with three other civilians, on suspicion of the murder. They were released without charge after about 24 hours. But what we had discovered ourselves in the interim, and the events that then took place, the evidence that came out at the inquest, it was extremely disturbing. We were in a state of absolute shock over what we could see, what we saw going on in front of us. And all of our cries for help, if you like, call it that, to, you know, the police complaints authority, to the Home Office, to the leading, the serving police, you know, senior police officers, were just ignored. You know, it was just, oh no, there's nothing wrong here, everything's fine, go away. That sort of attitude we were greeted with by the authorities.
I mean, what checks and balances, to your knowledge, are there that make sure that there isn't corruption within the police forces? Because, of course, we've covered a couple of times on here the whole thing about deaths in custody, where we've had hundreds of deaths without a single conviction of a police officer. I mean, is it your impression that part of being working at the Metropolitan Police is that you have a kind of badge of impunity, where if you do something wrong, you get found out, that your fellow police officers will cover for you?
Well, my perception is that there is a culture of cover-up in the British police, that criminal police officers, I don't know what the rationale is behind it, I have no idea. I mean, you could talk about, you know, backing your mates up or whatever it is, but my perception is that there is a culture of obfuscation, cover-up, delay, when it comes to police criminality in this country. I think very largely you could say that it was a, you know, a national phenomenon, but I think it's particularly apparent in the Metropolitan Police. I think that cover-up is the default, is their default reaction to everything almost.
Well, there's been five investigations, I understand, into your brother's murder. Can you just take us through, I mean, because that's dragged out now over, what, something like 30 years. Can you just take us through some of those and explain why it's, you know, been so many investigations into the same murder and still no solution?
No, well, as I said, the first investigation, the Met have now admitted, was corrupted. The second, I made a complaint about it. There was a second investigation, which I very quickly began to perceive as a whitewash of the first investigation, and yet I could do nothing about it. And in fact, the outside inquiry by Hampshire Police pronounced that the Met's first investigation had been squeaky clean, and it wasn't, you know. And then we protested for years. I was lobbying my MP. I had to move, in fact, because my MP in Hampshire just simply wasn't interested. I had to move to find an MP that was interested in it. And I came to London. My local MP, Chris Smith, became a cabinet minister in the last Labour administration in 1997. He was, if you like, representing me in this. And writing to the Home Office again and again and again and again and again, and having no effect whatsoever. Finally, the Met then carried out a third investigation behind our backs. after we'd been protesting at the way the first two had been handled, and which resulted in conviction some of the people suspected of the murder being convicted of other offences, but that didn't satisfy us. And then there was a fourth investigation where the CPS said that they didn't have enough evidence to prosecute. And at that point, we decided that we suspected very strongly that the police had been covering up their own involvement in the contract murder of a whistleblower. And we thought that, albeit that they might have finally tried to secure justice for us and failed, that this situation warranted a judicial inquiry. Just the fact that that something like this could occur, or that we perceived that it had occurred, is in my view alone enough for a judicial inquiry. But the Labour administration just sort of looked at what the police had done in the past, their pronouncements on there being no corruption, etc., etc., and just regurgitated the police line. We explained to them the complete sort of bankruptcy of the police's position, when we could say that we pointed to gigantic holes in investigations, but it was just like talking to a brick wall, the amount of letters that my MPs and others have written to the Home Office, I've got ring binders full of them, and it just didn't work. It was just like talking to thin air.
But hang on a minute, Alistair, yeah. Because I'm going to play devil's advocate here for a minute, but surely you have to accept that sometimes it's just simply not possible to solve a murder.
I agree. Some murders are never solved. I accept that, but what I can't accept is a murder which started out in this way, where it seemed to me absolutely obvious that here was a critical situation from a policing point of view that had arisen, where the integrity of the police was, the allegations were so serious, and the evidence pointing in that direction so strong that to mess up in the way that they did was completely unforgivable, absolutely unforgivable.
Now, can you give us an idea then of how, you obviously have your own view of this, you have done your own investigation into your brother's murder. How does a policeman become a murderer?
I do not know. As I said before, the motive behind my brother's murder, I'm absolutely sure, was that he was going to reveal corruption, police involvement with organized crime, that kind of level of criminality, and that he was murdered for that reason. And clearly, if that's what he was going to reveal, then there would be police officers who had an interest in getting involved in it.
So, is it possible for you at this date, or a long time after his murder, to reveal what your brother was unable to about some of the actual connections between organised crime and the Metropolitan Police?
I can. I can tell you that for legal reasons, I have to be careful here, but in some respects, but I believe that he wanted to expose police involvement in a cash robbery, in a substantial cash robbery. I also believe that it has been suggested to me by police officers investigating the case that Daniel was about to expose police involvement in drugs dealing on a major scale, possibly even weapons dealing, clearly very, very serious criminality.
No, you've actually rung a few bells in my mind there, because I can remember reading a book called The Filth by a former policeman, Duncan McLaughlin, and he's in his book, it was quite shocking. I think he was, even in the first few pages, he said that the shock for him when he was working for the drug squad was that actually they were so close to the people that they were supposed to be investigating, and they were drinking with them and this kind of thing, that they had actually become the best, this is the Scotland Yard drug squad, the best organised criminal gang in the country.
Well, that's the kind of thing that that is how serious and how difficult, you know, what a threat to normal law enforcement this kind of thing is. And that was why my, you know, for years and years I have been campaigning about this. You know, it's simply the idea that the police should turn their backs on that kind of level of criminality to me is just inconceivable.
Now, I mean, your case sounds to me like the perfect opportunity for somebody like Panorama to get their teeth into. World in Action, obviously, sadly, no longer with us. But there are a few documentary, you know, sort of fairly hard-hitting current affairs documentary series around. I mean, we actually had Roger Cook on here a few weeks ago. Unfortunately, he was taken out by the News of the World with a load of lies printed in the News of the World about his programme when ITV then pulled it. But, I mean, has there been any sort of comprehensive or even partial you know, sort of television documentary into Daniel's murder?
Yes, they have. In fact, Welsh television, if you can believe this, have done three. Welsh TV have done three, and ITV London did one in collaboration with ITV Wales. But there's never been a what we'd call, you know, a heavyweight nationwide, nationally broadcast documentary about the murder. And yet, I approached Panorama in about 2001, I think it was, and I said, "Look, this is really, really a serious case, this one." And I was told that it was the biggest police corruption story never told. This is what it was said. But no, we're not going to do it.
I mean, all I can suggest is you keep plugging away,
I will.
Alistair.
Oh, I certainly will. I mean, I mean, I have absolutely no intention whatsoever of giving up.
Now, onto the news this week about the Leveson inquiry. Quite clearly, the police, the Metropolitan Police, under the command of this guy John Yates, who's now over in Bahrain helping the riot police to, in some occasions, kill people who are out peacefully demonstrating in the streets of Bahrain, they failed to actually investigate properly the evidence that they had on that phone hacking was going on. And what does this revelation taught you? I mean, if anything, on what perspective does your case and your brother's murder bring to understanding, you know, what was wrong with the police and what Leveson looked into?
Well, as I mentioned earlier, since the collapse of the trial, the collapse of the prosecution in March last year, there have been a whole string of media revelations about the relationships between the suspects in Daniel's murder, who were formally acquitted when the prosecution collapsed last year, their relationship with journalists from the News of the World, which again has brought this murder right back into focus because of the, as I say, the relationship between the suspects and the News of the World, and the fact that Andy Coulson, former editor of the News of the World, and latterly government press secretary, had employed one of the suspects, and that this suspect had worked for the News of the World for many, many years and earned a great deal of money for them, amongst other things, by illegally providing information for them. I can't mention a name for legal reasons at the moment.
Okay, well, that's fascinating, Alistair. I'm going to bring old Labour Oxford economist Martin Summers in here. Martin, I mean, it's pretty shocking. Have you got any thoughts about the sorts of systems that should be in place to make sure that the police aren't able to get away with things like this? Because, I mean, as we saw in that Panorama documentary a couple of weeks ago, essentially, there is a sort of police club, and they're very reluctant to prosecute people who are also police officers.
Yeah, which is why Operation Countryman took place in the 1970s, was it, when West Country police officers went down and tried to clean the mess?
1980s, I think.
1980s. I mean, I actually know the pub concerned in which your brother died, because I used to work round the corner from it, and I used to live in South London during the 1980s. And, of course, the word on the street about the Stephen Lawrence affair was that the boys that had actually carried out the murder thought they could get away with it because their dad was the biggest drugs dealer in South London, and he got the cops on the payroll. And I think it's the same sort of people we're talking about. And a lot of this is covered in, is it Michael Gillard's book, The Untouchables, Tony?
Michael Gillard and Laurie Flynn's book, Untouchables,
because we've had them on this show previously.
The trouble with that book is it's very difficult to get hold of. It's like gold dust. They only did one printing
indeed,
of it.
Indeed, they were Guardian journalists investigating the corruption. I think it's the set where we're all talking about the same nest of corruption in South London. And of course, the Guardian wouldn't back them up, and they had to go and publish it independently. But it's the fact that these same faces are still popping up all these years later in relation to Leveson rings alarm bells in my mind. Is that, you know, for years we've had a situation where basically criminal police officers who are working with organised crime have not only been allowed to get away with it, they've been protected right up to the top. And I think that just says a lot about the kind of society we live in, which is not nearly as free and fair as people imagine it to be.
Well, never mind that, Martin. What about doing something about it? How is it possible to actually beef up the police complaints procedure to actually make sure that police officers who are corrupt, seriously, they get their collars felt and they go to jail?
Well, what we're doing, the first step, which is making sure that people are aware of the facts. What should happen is an outside force should go in and investigate the Met, perhaps send the Police Service of Northern Ireland. That's the people I'd give this job to.
Alistair, what's your view on that?
Well, I think... As far as the prosecution is concerned, we've been told by the CPS, by the Met anyway, and I've been advised by my solicitor that a prosecution of those involved in Daniel's murder at this stage, and after five investigations, and after the case having been messed up legally so badly, there is absolutely no, virtually no chance whatsoever that Daniel's killers will ever be brought to justice. So we're now in a position where all we want is for the public to see how this case was investigated and the questions that raises about the ethos and integrity of our police. Because if you don't see what's been going on, you can't do anything about it, can you? If the public don't know what's been happening, then we can do nothing about it.
And what's your own view on the possible similarities with the Stephen Lawrence case, which thankfully has been sorted out recently?
Well, I mean, there are still question marks about that. I believe there is a corruption inquiry going into ongoing in corruption inquiry into that case after the prosecution.
Yeah, because of course the thing is that if the police haven't done their job and prosecuted properly, then surely the law should come down on them like a ton of bricks.
Well, I agree. But again, I think it needs an independent, or we are seeking an independent inquiry into Daniel's murder. We reached a stage, and we told the Home Secretary when we saw her in December last year, that we do not want a police investigation into this. We don't trust the police any longer. You know, we don't want police anywhere near it, is what we, the position we've reached, you know. So, as I said, you know, prosecutions, I think, are pie in the sky as far as we're concerned now. But I think the only thing we can hope for is to find out what has been happening, what is really behind this. Why, for example, did the News of the World try to interfere with an investigation into Daniel's murder?
Alistair, how can listeners follow what's going on? And, I mean, I understand you've got a website, and what do you think people can do, you know, about this, to sort of help the cause?
People that tweet, people can email their MPs about it, say that they're worried about the Daniel Morgan case. You know, a simple email just saying that that the murder of the private investigator Daniel Morgan is a very worrying case and needs to please contact the Home Secretary. You know, urge your MPs to contact the Home Secretary. But for me, just the fact that I can talk to the public about it is, I think, a great thing. You know, if I can just educate and teach people. I say educate, that sounds pompous, but just tell people what's going on, you know.
Okay, and where's your website, finally, Alistair?
It's www.justiceforDaniel, justicefigure4daniel.org, and also I tweet under my own name, Alistair Morgan, at Alistair Morgan, and one word, and another. There's another tweet stream under Justice for Daniel, at Justice for Daniel. And I'm finding that I can get the message out to people via these media, because the mainstream media, I don't think, for a long time, have been, you know, particularly caring about the public interest, and in particular when it involves this nexus of police, media and politicians. You know, it's a sort of nasty little tripos there, and needs to be exposed.
Yes, a little nest of vipers. Anyway, Alistair, lovely to speak to you, and we wish you all the best with Dispatches and Panorama over the next 6 months or so.
We'll be keeping up our campaign, Tony, don't worry, and thank you for having me on the show.
No problem. Anytime. Bye. Anytime.
Bye.
Drive Time on BCFM, 5 till 7 on 93.2 FM.
Well, that was Alistair Morgan. And now to Gwyneth Powell-Davis. Hi, Gwyneth, and welcome to Drive Time.
Hello.
Now, you're the Health Branch Vice Chair at Unite, and tell us what's going on tomorrow.
Tomorrow we've got the We Are One NHS demonstration, marching from College Green by the Council House. We're going to set off at 11:30, gathering from 11 o'clock, and we're going to march through town to Castle Park. There'll be a rally with speeches, and I'm quite excited about it. I think there's going to be people on this demonstration who've never marched before.
Okay, what unions are you representing then? I mean, you're from Unite, but that's not the only union in the health service, is it?
No, I mean, there's any number of unions in the health service, probably most of the ones you could think of are represented. So we have larger ones such as Unison, as well as Unite, the GMB, the RCN, the Nurses Union. We also have the Midwives Union, the Hospital Consultants Association, dietitians, physiotherapists, radiographers who do the x-rays, dietitians who do a very important job making sure people have a good diet in hospital. All the unions that you could think of represented.
So if people see you in town, they know what it's about, and they could even join in if they feel like it. Now, what about the cause, though? Because this is about regional pay, at least that's one of the things, isn't it?
Yes, that's right.
So can you tell us what's wrong with that? I mean, surely the idea, one of the actually good things about the idea of privatising the health service, which has been floated originally by New Labour, not just by the coalition government, let's not forget that, is that that the pay will reflect better the conditions. So, for example, more pay for people working in London, because the rents are very much higher and the cost of living is higher, and less, say, for example, in a little backwater in a little village in Devon somewhere.
Well, I think there's any number of things that can be said to that. Firstly, while we're on national pay, you are recognising that people are worth the same wherever they work in the country for the skills they have. And you can deal with issues such as London through waiting, London waiting, for example. And I don't think anybody should be under any illusions that Bristol, that's a bit of an expensive place to live, we're going to get more pay. It's quite clear from the information that has come out from what the employers' plans are, that this is about saving the money that they have to save. The health service has got to save about £5 billion a year. We're sort of 2 years of trying to save that, and we're looking at another two and then another four, you know, saving. This is the projected savings. Managers within the health service are under huge pressure to make savings any way they can. This is absolutely not about just finding a fair regional pay. It's about pay cuts. Privatisation, I think, is a huge danger to the health service. I look at it in quite simple terms. You provide a service, you've also got to have the column that, you know, where somebody makes some money out of it. People like Richard Branson are queuing up to run parts of our health service at the moment. They would not be doing that if they didn't think there was a profit to be made. So that means our NHS money going direct into the profits of shareholders.
What about the membership? How many people are there in the Bristol area working in the health service? Because we go past these various hospitals, yeah, and you know, it's just nice to get an idea, yeah, of how many people there are.
Yeah, it's huge. Because we're always reorganising the NHS, you can always say it depends how you count it. But I could, you know, with community workers as well in North Bristol Trust, for example, I would say you could go to 9,000, certainly. You know, within the acute hospitals, you'll be the two big hospital trusts in Bristol, North Bristol and University Hospitals Bristol. You know, you're probably talking about 7,500 within the actual hospitals, not out in the community each. So it's a lot of people.
You're also, I mean, I think I'm quite right in saying, aren't I, that both of the chairmen of the two trusts are both merchant venturers. You've got John Savage, who's the chairman of the Central Bristol, what is it, UHB Hospital Trust, and the North Bristol NHS Trust chairman. He's now the master of the merchant venturers. Martin, it just sounds like almost nothing has changed over the last 200-300 years. These people are still incredibly wealthy and incredibly powerful.
Well, yes, and I think also the thing about regional pay is the purpose of having national pay is that the more depressed regions of Britain are given an indirect subsidy by making sure that wages are higher in, say, Cornwall than they would otherwise be. Now, what that means, in fact, is that the economy runs more efficiently, because if you concentrate all the money in the southeast of England, what happens is that property prices, can you believe this, property prices are rising in parts of London, even as we speak, even as the property market elsewhere is on its back. Now, if you thrust everything into the southeast cauldron, as it were, you then get an inflation problem. So you then have to try and solve the problem of inflation. There was a reason for having a national health service with national standards, and it's not irrational to keep to those standards. What's happened under New Labour and under the current administration is basically a retreat from what we knew in the 1940s and 1950s about national structures and national plans. Having a free market and a competition is not always the most rational or even the most efficient way to spend money. And we've got to make, that's got to be reiterated. The attacks that the coalition government are making on the NHS, we've got to make the case for the NHS in a general way, and not be ashamed of making that case.
Gwyneth, what's your thoughts about the actual case for it? Because at the moment, a lot of people are saying, well, I'm sorry, but there simply isn't enough money within the Treasury to continue with the health service we've had in the past. We need to bring in this private money. It's almost sort of talking myself down here. I know at Hinchinbrook Hospital, I think, which is, isn't it Leicester or Cambridge, which is a Circle Healthcare have taken over, they've actually found that even they can't make it pay. So what ultimately is the point in keeping the NHS in public ownership?
Well, I think, you know, in my family, you have people who lived in the generation where it was about fear if you got ill. I think we've had our health service for long enough now that perhaps some people have start to take it for granted, but it makes a huge difference to everybody's lives not to have to be frightened about getting ill. It's bad enough getting ill. This is a service that we want for everybody in this country. And in fact, I don't think there is any private money being brought in. It's absolutely, to me, a step up to the private sector. It's a matter of the private sector looking for new places to make profits and starting to intervene into what was the public sector, and it is not any good to us and our health services. It's something that is purely detrimental, and I think we have evidence from America where the system almost completely privatised has always cost, if you look at GDP, a far bigger proportion. Our health service, our NHS, has always been one of the most efficient systems if you look at what proportion of the national domestic product it costs. We want to keep that system. We also want to keep a system where people can be proud of putting care first. I think as soon as you're sort of having to think about surpluses it completely skews the sort of services you give, where you, I've already heard these sort of discussions going on where the NHS is being forced into a market system, you know, hospital managers having to look at what will attract more money rather than what do our local people need.
Yeah, what about these plans to bring doctors in to become health service managers and sort of manage budgets? What's the feeling down at the hospitals around, you know, and your work colleagues around whether that's going to work or not?
Well, I think one of the issues that does worry people is, you know, loss of patient trust, you know, the conflict of interest. Because if your doctor has a budget and says, oh, I don't think you should get this treatment, you know, that could break down patient trust. Because is that the doctor saying that because they don't think it's particularly effective treatment for you? Or is it because they're getting to the end of their budget for that treatment? There's also the concern that this is a way in for privatisation. I mean, doctors are medics. They're going to need to, in many cases, employ people to do the contract work. And there are indeed private companies who are looking to take on this work for doctors. So I think the idea that doctors have the money and therefore it'll go to the right place under the new Health Act is not really what we're going to see.
Martin, we've also had recently the news from, I think it was South London, that some of the trusts have been going bust. I mean, it sounds like the NHS is actually limping along a little bit at the moment and having problems surviving under the current regime.
Well, I think the fundamental problem here is this idea that market interactions are somehow more efficient than having a plan. Now, in World War II, we didn't tender for who would like to go onto the beaches on D-Day, did we? I mean, in actual fact,
isn't World War II.
No, but I mean, the government was saying the other day that the economic crisis we're in is similar to wartime, and in many ways it is. But in actual fact, the idea of having a national plan, but the OECD did a study on an international comparison of healthcare systems, and you're quite right, Gwyneth, isn't it?
Yes.
The British National Health Service came out as the most efficient system in terms of money spent. Because it is, in actual fact, having a plan from the centre and buying everything in bulk. For example, all of the pharmaceuticals you buy in bulk, you negotiate from strength with the pharmaceutical companies rather than a little consortium which has been bombarded with buy some of this new stuff. We've got, we'll give you it on discount. Actually, having a central plan is a more efficient setup. And the only thing that made Britain not so good in the league tables that they were looking at is our outcomes were not as good as in France or Germany. But that's because in France or Germany, they spend double what we spend on healthcare. And in the US, I think it's like 15 or 16% of GNP goes on healthcare. In Britain, it's 5%. In actual fact, the market is the least efficient way to provide universal healthcare. But everybody, including New Labour, bought into the idea that a bit of market won't do any harm. And I say, as an economist, no, in this particular case, the market should be told to get lost.
Another bit of news this week about the health service, consultations by Skype. The NHS is turning into Dr. Google, and we should be worried. I think this was from the Telegraph blog, this one. What about this, Gwyneth? It seems like, you know, actually that could save some money, couldn't it? If you go on your laptop or whatever and go onto Skype and talk to your doctor that way.
Well, it's not an idea I've come across. Again, I'm always very suspicious if there's people, you know, companies looking for, you know, their angle and how they can make money.
Well, they're saying people are expensive. That's what they're saying.
Yes,
I mean,
indeed,
you need staff to man a, you know, sort of reception and all that kind of thing. In fact, a lot of this is becoming more computerized by the day. I mean, isn't this sort of inevitable role of technology?
I think, you know, technology does come into the health service and it should be welcomed where it's actually improving healthcare for people. What's so important is that, you know, there can be a plan so that changes are made because they are beneficial rather than simply because they save money.
Yeah, and also Jeremy Hunt, who's now the he was the in charge of steering the B Sky B bid through, which didn't actually manage to make it eventually for the coalition government. He's now been, I suppose, promoted really from culture, media and sport into the Department of Health. And he's saying that there will be a promise that health records will go online by 2015. Now, that sounds a little bit dodgy. I don't know if I want my health records going online. I suppose it's some sort of central, super secure database. But anyway, what about him as a health secretary? How's he panning out, Gwyneth?
I think many of us are very concerned about a health secretary who we do not believe is signed up and committed to a public health service, as you know, arguments that have been put here. I think public health service is worth fighting for. And certainly, you know, that's why I think tomorrow's march, if anybody's in Bristol, is not only about our pay, it's also about the service we can provide and defending the NHS from privatisation.
This report, this NHS mandate thing, he's saying that for every 1% reduction in face-to-face appointments, the NHS saves £200 million. But I don't know, maybe it's a step backwards. Anyhow, Gwyneth, can you just remind us of when your march is taking place tomorrow and where?
Yeah, we'll be gathering at College Green at 11 o'clock in the morning. Everybody's very welcome. It's our NHS. It needs defending. We will be taking a march through the centre and around the Broadmead shops, and we hope people might just take a little bit of time out if they're there doing their Christmas shopping and join us and have a fight to say, let's defend our NHS.
Well, Gwyneth Powell-Davis from Unite the Union, Health Branch Vice Chair, thanks very much for joining us on Drive Time.
Drive Time on BCFM, 5 till 7 on 93.2 FM.
Now, Martin Summers, our little scoot round the world this week. The appointment of Mark Carney, the new Governor of the Bank of England. This is quite interesting because he is not only a former member of this company, Goldman Sachs, which seems to now be slowly taking over Europe. I mean, I saw a fantastic graphic on the InfoWars website, which shows you just how many countries have Goldman Sachs people in the driving seat. We've got Belgium, Germany, and as well as Greece, Italy, France and Ireland, all got Goldman Sachs people in some of the top jobs to do with their so-called democratic finance. And now we've got this guy, Mark Carney too, who's a Goldman Sachs boy.
Well, I must admit, I've never heard of this chap before he was nominated, but I've been reading about
him. You haven't been reading your Bilderberg attendance list,
no,
have you?
Well, no, I mean, the fact is that he is exactly from Stuff Central. He's a Bilderberger, he's a Goldman Sachs boy, and those are the people who have been put in charge of the world economy at every, you know, whether you vote for them or not, they are the ones who are running things.
Well, there was a secret, we reported on here, didn't we, a secret meeting of the Bilderberg Steering Committee over in Rome 2 weeks ago, and so maybe he was being discussed there, goodness knows.
Well, I'll be quite sure. I mean, you know how these kind of elite clubs work. Unless he was a person in good standing within those clubs, he wouldn't be in any contention whatever to be Governor of the Bank of England.
Give us an idea of the Bilderberg stroke Goldman Sachs mindset, because what sort of policies will he bring to the job of Governor of the Bank of England?
Well, I presume that basically what they're trying to do is preserve the existing financial setup, despite the fact that it only exists because it's been bailed out by the taxpayer. This is the big elephant in the room. We're talking about cutting budgets in the NHS, but in actual fact, when we're talking about propping up the banking system, money's no object. And a huge amount of money, the public sector borrowing requirement in Britain doesn't even include the money that we've spent on the banks, because in theory we're going to get that money back. But I have something to tell you folks out there in Radio Land, we're not going to get that money back, so the debt situation of the government is far worse than they're saying. But of course, you can't cut your way out of a crash. And at a certain point, the private markets, even though they've been bailed out by the state, will crash. And at that point, people will wake up and say, actually, the private market system as a system is finished, and I'm afraid it is. And of course, people in the 40s knew that, and the setting up of a national health service in Britain was part of creating a post capitalist Britain, if you like. But, I mean, it was the first step.
The health service is quite important, but surely even more important is the money system. And if the money system is in private hands, being used by people for their own private profit, surely, I mean, this guy is not going to be the guy who's going to nationalise the Bank of England, is he?
Well, the Bank of England was supposedly nationalised in the 1940s.
But it's not acting in the national interest. It's giving loads of money to these zombie banks.
It's been given independence.
It's giving money to the zombie banks, and those zombie banks, dead banks, basically, are not lending it on to the public.
No, because in the middle of a crash, you'd be a fool if you did. So what's actually happening is profiteering by using political power. So Goldman Sachs, for example, which should have been liquidated, were powerful enough, they were bailed out, and then they're powerful enough to control the political process with the money that they've given, the bailout money, which keeps them in the game. They're one of the most leveraged, they're classified as a bank, so that they can receive funding from the US government, but they are the most highly leveraged of all. I've been seeing stuff, a normal bank will be leveraged, in the good old days, would be leveraged 10 or 12%.
So that means that they've got 10 or 12 times, they're lending out 10 or 12 times more money than they've actually got.
Yes, which is a standard thing for a bank.
So they're making money up out of nowhere.
But if you look at major banks now, they're at 30 or 40 times what they've actually got on the books. Goldman Sachs has got something like 1,400 times what they've got on the books. So they really are the sharp end of the sharp end. They should have been liquidated. Instead of being liquidated, I mean, Matt Taibbi in the US calls them a vampire squid on the face of humanity. And Goldman Sachs is very much at the heart of political power in the US and in Britain. And of course, they're pushing exactly these kind of policies on regional pay that we're seeing.
It sounds to me like we could be actually looking back to the days when sleepy Mervyn King and his soporific pronouncements were ruling the monetary system, and as this kind of Dracula character takes over.
Yeah, well, I think one of the things they're pushing him is because Canada basically did reduce their deficit in the 90s by cutting public expenditure. So I imagine that's why Osborne's brought him in as centre-forward, because he's got a track record, or at least Canada's got a track record. Although in actual fact, in the Canadian press, they've been saying he's just leaving just at the moment when things are going sour in Canada. So he's got a transfer to Man United, having you know, Canada's just about to be relegated. But I mean, the fact is that the Canadians in the 90s were able to cut their public expenditure by, you know, to get their deficit down by cutting public expenditure, because they had a boom in the United States with their major trading partner, because it was the Clinton era and the dot-com boom was raging. So they were able to bring down their deficit by cutting public expenditure, but they're the only people who've ever done it, and it's very, very bizarre circumstances.
So this guy,
you can't cut your way out of a deficit. The deficit is now going to go up as we go forward, and at that point, at a certain point, the ordinary people are going to twig that all of this cut stuff is not actually reducing the deficit, and at that point the government will implode.
So it sounds like this Mark Carney guy is going to be like the king of the vampire squid loan sharks.
Well, he's going to be in house for 4-5 years, so let's say there's a change of government, he'll still be there. So even if we change the government, he'll still be there pushing this agenda.
And that's, of course, the guy who's appointed him, George Osborne, is himself a Bilderberger.
Well, they all
Drive Time on BCFM, 5 till 7 on 93.2 FM.
And total blackout in Syria as they go offline nationwide yesterday. Seems like while Leveson was going on, our eyes were not really looking at Syria, but there's a major attack on the airport there, Martin. How do you think things are going in Syria? And, you know, who's responsible? Which way is it heading?
Well, obviously, it's very difficult to say, sitting in a radio studio in Bristol, what's going on. But I understand there is serious talk of a peacekeeping force from China and Russia coming in the new year to separate the combatants. And Obama may have to swallow that, because he's not strong enough to stop them.
Drive Time on BCFM, 5 till 7 on 93.2 FM.
Finally, fueled by the war on drugs, the Mexican death toll could reach 120,000 people as Calderon ends his 6-year reign as the president. Martin, this drug war in Mexico is horrendous, and of course one of the really embarrassingly horrific sides of this is that Lord Green, when he was at HSBC, was presiding over the money laundering for these Mexican drug cartels, where he was running all their loot around in his armoured vehicles, backwards and forwards, and making sure that no one else could get their hands on it. This guy is now in the cabinet.
Yeah, well, I mean, the drugs trade, I mean,
I think he's a minister, he's not quite in the cabinet.
I mean, there's a UN report from the UN Office on Drugs and Crime, which came out a couple of years ago, which pointed out that during the financial crisis of 2008, all of the drug cartels went straight to the top of the banks and said, hey, you guys need some money, you're having a panic, aren't you? And he said, yes, we're having a panic. Do you know what? We've got some. And so all the dirty money all over the world was immediately just absorbed into the financial system at that point. any questions that people had about it were just brushed aside in the panic. So in actual fact, the private financial system is being propped up A, by the taxpayer, and B, by the drug cartels. And the drug cartels, of course, have been in alliance with the Western Intelligence Services for many years, as anybody on the street in Mexico will tell you. But of course, they don't really know much about that in the home counties.
Drive Time on BCFM, 5 till 7 on 93.2 FM.
Oh, you must let me do my jingles, Martin. Anyway, the final item tonight is looking at Somalia. And here we hear from Omar Farouk Osman, who's the president of the Federation of African Journalists. He's also the chief of the Somali Journalists Union.
My name is Omar Farouk Osman. I'm the Secretary General of the National Union of Somali Journalists. I happen to be the president of the Federation of African Journalists, which is a conglomerate of unions of journalists from the African continent. We are now 44 African countries representing 80,000 journalists.
Tell us, from your overview, what is the state of play with journalism across the continent?
The journalism profession is now the riskiest profession to be practiced in Africa because journalism has been criminalized by all forces who do not want to hear or see uncomfortable truth, and they want to suppress it. Journalists are also being killed and targeted because of, you know, reporting of something that one does not like to be reported. And what happened is more than that. Is the way the life of the journalist is being given, you know, hard time in terms of promoting press freedom, in terms of giving voice to the voiceless people, to the minorities, to the women, to the children, and then they are being suppressed because of that.
Can you give us an idea of some of the stories which journalists have been reporting in different countries that have actually led to them being killed?
Stories that relate to the human rights violations, crimes against humanity, rape, you know, violence against women, corruption, you know, internal wranglings of government officials, you know, public office misuse, public resources misuse. These have been issues that are mindful for journalists, and if you touch them, then you fear for your life because no one is going to protect you.
What about countries, though? Which are the, could we say, the worst countries in on the continent?
Somalia is the worst country for journalists in the continent, and I say that because it is the deadliest country for journalists in 4 years in a row, because this year alone, 15 journalists were killed so far. Which makes, you know, extremely ununderstandable the way the violence and the killing of journalists has increased. What is also shocking is the way that Eritrean journalists are being detained, which makes Eritrea the worst jailer of journalists in Africa, with 32 journalists behind the bars incommunicado.
Well, that was Omar Farouk Osman, from the president of the Federation of African Journalists. I'm joined in the studio now by Latif Ismail, former chair of the Somali Forum here in Bristol. What he's saying there essentially is that it is the most dangerous profession in Africa, is to be a journalist. Just give us a brief update, because we haven't got a lot of time, on what is the political situation like over in Somalia at the moment, because what we always hear about is these pirates, and many people are asking, are these pirates being sponsored by other countries from outside Somalia?
Well, Somalia has been experiencing conflict for more than 20 years now. Most British newspapers and media talk about this when the state collapsed in 1991, but the conflict has been ongoing before that, at least I would say 5 to 10 years before that. What's been happening since then is you had warlordism, you have piracy, which you mentioned, happening on the coast of Somalia, and you also have a group of armed militia called Al-Shabaab, who've been described as terrorist group affiliated to Al-Qaeda. coming back to your question, Tony, regarding piracy, let me address how piracy started in Somalia. It started because Somali seas had been plundered by foreign trawlers, most of them from Far East Asia, but also Europeans and some African states. Now, the fishermen who used to rely on fishing for their livelihood were suddenly being put out of business. So in order to fight back, they started fining and capturing ships. And then someone or some people realized that they can turn business into this. So it's a criminal act. It's not one I'm defending, but I think we need to look at the root causes of piracy.
And what about the proximity to the other problems in the Middle East? Because Somalia is really quite close to Iran, isn't it?
It's very close to the Middle East. It's in fact round the corner from where the 60% of the world's oil is deposited. In fact, the distance between Somalia and the Middle East is less than the distance between Dover and Calais. So it's very, very close. That's why, and it sits on a very important strategic route where huge ships that carry goods that come to the countries like the United Kingdom use. Hence why the UK is contributing both to the NATO force as well as the EU NAFTA force fighting piracy off the coast of Somalia.
Okay, very briefly, Martin, just a few seconds, can you just give us your take on any kind of possible solutions in Somalia?
Well, I mean, it's hard to say solutions, but I think Somalia also is in a geopolitical football for everybody. Al-Shabaab is being touted as Al-Qaeda, as you say, but then the Ethiopians invaded with American support. And Somalia is being ripped apart by foreign interventions of various
kinds. Okay, Martin, thanks very much. Time to sign off now. Now it's time for the typical topical Afro-tropical show after the news. Next week we go into Christmas with Bristol's homeless hostels and food banks.
.org.uk BCFM News from the Sky News Centre.
From the Sky News Centre at 7, the father of Madeleine McCann says he's dismayed by the Prime Minister's reluctance to implement the key Leveson recommendation. That's for legislation to underpin a new independent press regulator. Victims of media intrusion have launched a petition to get every suggestion adopted. Jerry McCann says people can't be allowed to suffer as his family have.
It was like being in the eye of a storm. We didn't want to show our face. We couldn't escape it. You put television on at night, there were front page news headlines with all sorts of ridiculous, ludicrous stories. And